Welcome to another episode of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler, and today is Monday, November 9th. The latest installment of Oncology Peer Review On The Go examines an article published in the October issue of the journal Oncology titled, Barriers to Clinical Trial Enrollment in Patients with Pancreatic Adenocarcinoma Who Are Eligible for Early Phase Clinical Trials. The piece focuses on what keeps patients of this aggressive form of pancreatic cancer from pursuing enrollment in clinical trials. For a summary of this study, I spoke with lead author Dr. Rachel Galvin from the Swedish Medical Center in Englewood, Colorado. Dr. Galvin, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today to discuss your piece in the journal Oncology. I was hoping you could first just give a brief overview of your research and some of the key findings you had.
Okay, yeah, thank you for having me. So our article looks specifically at patients with refractory or metastatic pancreatic adenocarcinoma that were referred to Sarah Cannon Research Institute. So our institution is a tertiary referral center. So we mainly get referrals from patients that have failed first or second line treatments for their cancers. This study is really unique, I think, in that it looks specifically at one phase one clinical trials, which there hasn't been, to our knowledge, there hasn't been research looking specifically at phase one clinical trials. And it looks at patients that qualified for these clinical trials but chose not to enroll. So we were really interested in seeing why patients wouldn't enroll in a clinical trial if they did qualify, because one of the main cited barriers is clearly the difficulty in meeting qualification criteria to enroll in the trial. But these patients did meet those criteria and chose not to enroll. So that's specifically what we looked at.
And so the research mentions that you utilize this chart review process to gather the results. Could you talk a little bit about what that is? And then the criteria that you used for a patient to be included in the population?
Yep. So, I mean, we kind of did it old school style. We dug through the charts. We looked at, we compiled a list of all the patients who were referred to our center who had pancreatic adenocarcinoma. So that's where we started. And then we looked, the criteria were that the patient one was diagnosed with refractory or metastatic pancreatic adenocarcinoma, which I'm just going to say PDAC because it's way easier. and then they had to have qualified for a clinical trial enrollment. And the way we determined that was they had to have had molecular profiling. So that could be tissue-based or blood-based molecular profiling and then qualified for a clinical trial based on that. We then further broke down the patients by so we identified 74 patients who had that diagnosis and got genomic profiling. And then of those, 54 then qualified for a clinical trial. So then we dug further into the chart and found out whether they did go on to enroll. And then most physicians had documented in the chart why they chose not to enroll. So we extracted all that data into a spreadsheet and then kind of reviewed all of that.
Perfect. And so there were really two distinct groups here that I noticed, those being patients who qualified for clinical trials and participated versus those who qualified but chose not to participate. What were some of the main differences in those groups? And did you see any patterns that stuck out to you and your colleagues?
So one of the things that's hard about studying PDAC patients is it's a rapidly deadly disease. It's often diagnosed very late. So our sample size is relatively small. The two statistically significant differences we found were one, patients who had more clinical diagnoses of anxiety and depression were more likely to enroll in clinical trials, which is kind of interesting when you think about that. And then we also saw that the number of prior treatments that patients had received, those patients who had undergone more treatments were more likely to enroll in clinical trials.
And so the research cites nine categories of barriers for not enrolling in clinical trials. What were some of the most common barriers that you found, and what do you recommend be done to combat some of them?
So like I mentioned, this cancer is really aggressive. So one of the most common reasons for patients not enrolling was actually death or transition to hospice or decline in their functional status. So when you group all that together, that was actually the largest barrier. Another barrier was delay in enrollment. So I think those are kind of intertwined. In a cancer that's so aggressive and has such a high mortality and short-term survival, a delay in enrolling on the trial or a delay in the progress of the trial can have a significant impact. Those patients can progress onto hospice. So I think one of the things we really need to improve upon is getting patients onto trial more quickly. So there's a lot of regulatory and administrative burden that trials face. And I know a lot of cancer organizations have recently implemented initiatives to try to address that. And I think it's really important we continue to do that. Most of our patients who were delayed onto enrollment, it was actually just lack of trial slot availability. So that's kind of difficult to address. And those patients, a few patients did end up going elsewhere where they could get on a trial. Another barrier that's cited, not just in our trial, but in other studies, is fear of adverse effects. So I think it becomes a little bit difficult in phase one clinical trials because we don't always know the adverse effects of that drug because it's an early phase clinical trial. But I do think there could be improved education to patients about potential adverse effects and what adverse effects could be attributed to the medication versus just progression of the disease process. So even if we don't fully know the adverse effects associated with the drug being studied in the phase one trial, I think giving patients information about perhaps like the class of drug or what they've seen in other patients could be helpful.
In the research, you and your colleagues came to this conclusion that understanding why patients don't participate in clinical trials provides, quote, insight into the patient experience and can help identify misperceptions and areas for improvement in education in the clinical trial enrollment process. I was hoping you can expand a little bit on this thought. And are there things that you have in mind that would improve these problems?
I think it's important to state that clinical trials may not be the right choice for every patient. But I do think it's important that patients get adequate education about what the whole process looks like and what they can expect so that they're making informed decisions. And I think there's been research about patient navigators and the use of patient navigators in cancer patients and specifically in clinical trials. We do have patient navigators at our facility, but I think they could be better utilized. And I think that could really help improve the process. I mean, when you get a cancer diagnosis, I think patients are overwhelmed. These patients in particular have metastatic or refractory disease. So they've, you know, been dealing with this for a while. So I think having that support and really focusing on their health literacy and what they're understanding about what it means to go on clinical trial is very important. So getting more information about why patients are saying no kind of helps us understand where we can improve in our education process and our informed consent process.
And so going off of that, with such an aggressive disease like the one we're discussing, how do you see the willingness for patients to enroll in clinical trials changing in the next 5 to 10 years? You know, are there any trends that can provide some kind of insight into the future?
I think generally the number of clinical trials we're seeing out there has increased significantly in recent years. I think the widespread use of social media has really shed a lot of light on more rare diseases. So maybe it's some optimism, but I expect that clinical trial enrollment will increase. I think it's really important these diseases, there's not very many treatment options that are effective. So you really run out of treatment options quickly. So I imagine as pancreatic cancer has really come into the spotlight more, I think more patients will be moving towards getting more information about clinical trials sooner. And hopefully that can lead to increased enrollment and ability to find new treatment options for these patients because it's very needed.
Right. And then lastly, is there anything that I haven't mentioned regarding the research that you feel is important to share?
I think one of the things that I thought was interesting and kind of surprised me was that the patients who had more clinical diagnoses of anxiety and depression, more of those patients ended up going on to trial. I can't say that we have a very good answer as to why. And I think that more research is needed into that aspect. So these patients already had the diagnoses, but they have recurrent disease. So they'd already been treated elsewhere. A lot of cancer patients end up having an adjustment disorder, anxiety, depression related to their cancer diagnosis. So I'd like in future research, I'd really like to get more information about when the patient was diagnosed, whether they're treated and they feel like their symptoms are adequately controlled, and how we can support cancer patients from like a psychological perspective so that they are, you know, better coping with their disease.
So I was just going to say, and is that an avenue of research that you and your colleagues might pursue in the future?
I'm definitely interested in more looking more at that because it wasn't something I really expected to find. When we were getting all our data, we recorded all their comorbidities. And so that was just something we ended up doing as kind of an add-on at the end of the analysis. And we were like, this is really interesting. And it makes sense if you have a cancer diagnosis that you're going to have some anxiety and depressive symptoms. So I think assessing those symptoms and whether they're controlled and whether they've been addressed is important because it's going to impact their willingness to seek any care, let alone a clinical trial.
Great. Well, Dr. Galvin, thank you so much for your time and taking the time to discuss your research with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was nice talking to you.
For the study's response perspective, I spoke with Dr. Michael Lee of the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Lee discussed his perspective piece published on Cancer Network titled Barriers to Pancreatic Cancer Clinical Trials Enrollment. The piece examines Dr. Galvin's work and clinical trial enrollment for the disease as a whole. Dr. Lee, thank you so much for taking the time to jump on the podcast today. I was hoping we could talk a little bit about the article that came out in the journal Oncology entitled Barriers to Clinical Trial Enrollment in Patients with Pancreatic Adenocarcinoma Who Are Eligible for Early Phase Clinical Trials. What were some of the points that stood out to you as really significant or important?
The article that you're referencing was a retrospective analysis of patients at a single institution who were considered eligible for potential clinical trials, early phase clinical trials who had refractory or metastatic pancreatic adenocarcinoma. And the main objective of the study was to identify factors that contributed to patients ultimately not enrolling in a clinical trial. The study looked at 54 patients who were considered eligible for a clinical trial and found that only about 51% of patients ultimately ended up enrolling, while the remainder, nearly half of the patients, did not enroll. Some of the more common barriers to enrollment included the perceived time commitment, the wait time until being able to enroll, and fear of side effects. Another significant proportion of patients ended up being lost to follow-up or didn't have a clear reason for proceeding on the study. And then another significant group of patients either died or transitioned to hospice or had a rapid decline in their functional status. Overall, I think this study really highlights many barriers that we experience in enrolling patients to clinical trials in pancreatic cancer, either kind of phase one or a more advanced phase two, three studies, and really highlighted a few key important points. First, I think the time delays until getting on study are a barrier. And I think also the significant proportion of patients who had rapid functional decline or ultimately ended up dying or transitioning goals of care to hospice are particular factors that we need to consider in patients with metastatic pancreatic cancer in particular.
And so you also wrote a perspective with a colleague on this article for the journal Oncology and Cancer Network. Could you talk a little bit about this perspective and some of the key points you hope to make in that piece?
Right. So I wrote this article with my colleague, Dr. Shubham Pant here at MD Anderson. We both see pancreatic cancer patients here. And we were primarily motivated to write this perspective because we agree very strongly along with ASCO and NCCN guidelines that patients with advanced pancreatic cancer or even earlier stage pancreatic cancer need to be considered for clinical trials. We know that outcomes for pancreatic cancer need to be improved. Pancreatic cancer had the lowest five-year relative survival of any cancer type diagnosed. And we know that even with advances in first-line and second-line therapy for metastatic pancreatic cancer, median survival based on the FOLFIRINOX protease studies is still shy of 1 year. So while there have been significant strides forward, there are still significant discoveries that we need to make. And because of this, we really want to highlight barriers to patient enrollment on clinical trials and motivate all of us as a community to identify ways we should be optimally designing our clinical trials and trying to optimally enroll patients on clinical trials.
So you mentioned it in that last response a little bit, what the next question would get at. But the perspective mentions that there are several domains of barriers that exist for patient enrollment, including structural, clinical, physician, and patient barriers. Could you expand on these domains a little bit and then explain why you found structural and clinical barriers were the most common?
Sure. I think all of these barriers actually play a role in limiting patient enrollment into clinical trials. So structural barriers touch on factors such as availability of clinical trials at a given location or at a given institution, other barriers to care in general. So, you know, if patients have limited access due to financial issues, if they have limited capability to travel to find a clinical trial, or even just limited wherewithal to know to be looking for clinical trials, these are all potential structural barriers. There have been meta-analyses and systematic reviews that have found that across cancer types, over half of patients did not have a clinical trial available relevant for their stage and specific type of cancer at their institution, which I think highlights the fact that this is a real barrier. Clinical barriers include inability to meet eligibility criteria. And, you know, on one hand, eligibility criteria certainly are important and exist so that we can enroll patient safety to go on studies and also ensure that the results of the trial are interpretable. But at the same time, there's been a concerted push by regulatory groups and in the FDA to really highlight that eligibility criteria need to be designed thoughtfully and avoid being overly stringent. Eligibility criteria also can sometimes play a role in some of these kinds of delays to enrolling on studies that I've been alluding to. So overly long washout periods being required in the eligibility criteria could also dissuade patients from going on study or may not be in the patient's best interest. So we generally feel that washout periods should be at most 28 days long, ideally less, just given the rapid deterioration that patients can experience with advanced pancreatic cancer. Physician barriers include the various reasons that a physician may not refer a patient who would otherwise be eligible for a clinical trial. And these sometimes, you know, may be relevant factors, including concerns about a lack of equipoise that the physician may have about a particular clinical trial. But it could also include other just barriers regarding whether enrolling in a clinical trial requires an undue amount of work for the physician, or whether the physician has the requisite knowledge to be aware of clinical trial, the appropriate clinical trials, and be identifying patients who are eligible for them. And finally, there are patient barriers, things where although the patient may well meet all eligibility criteria for a trial and be approached for a study, ultimately end up declining the study. There are a number of reasons why a patient may end up choosing to decline a study. And obviously this is undergoes patient autonomy, and you know, obviously ethically speaking, the patient is perfect, has the right and capability of deciding whether or not to enroll in a clinical trial. But you know, as a part of minimizing patient barriers, we want to make sure that we minimize any misinformation that patients may have or other misconceptions about clinical trials so that they can make the decision in a truly informed way.
With patient eligibility criteria, that brings us to the patient selection process that you talked a little bit about in the perspective. You mentioned some of these ideas, but could you talk a little bit about this idea of balancing the prioritizing patient safety and producing interpretable data while also dealing with overly stringent eligibility criteria? How do you modernize eligibility criteria to avoid unnecessarily restricting this patient enrollment?
So most eligibility criteria are designed in a way to ensure that patients are enrolled in such a way that we will know what to make of the data, right? So for example, one issue that often comes up but is usually reasonable is having RECIST measurable disease. Most trials do include measurements using RECIST version 1.1 to identify and define response or progression. And incumbent on that, patients must have a baseline measurable disease for the most part. And sometimes, honestly, this is a barrier for enrollment because patients may have a primary tumor that may have been resected or otherwise treated locally with radiation therapy. They may have non-measurable disease, in particular peritoneal carcinomatosis without nodules that are of sufficient size to be considered measurable. So this is an example of a potential barrier that we do see fairly commonly, but probably is there to enable meaningful data collection in the course of the study. Similarly, most lab cutoffs, for example, are typically required to ensure patient safety on the study. But with that being said, for the most part, any lab criteria that are included need to be approached thoughtfully. And while, you know, patient safety is paramount, at the same time, we know, for example, many patients with pancreatic cancer will also have venous thromboembolic disease as a consequence of their diagnosis and are on therapeutic anticoagulation. And so I would argue that unless there was a strong reason why a patient is absolutely contraindicated for safety reasons from being on anticoagulation or having a recently diagnosed pulmonary embolism or deep vein thrombosis, that those kinds of criteria in pancreatic cancer trials in particular need to be thought through very carefully and shouldn't be just kind of rotely included, because you're going to be restricting a lot of patients from enrolling, and it also makes the data less generalizable, because for the most part, it's quite common actually to have patients with newly or recently diagnosed metastatic pancreatic cancer experiencing these events. So that's a part of our routine clinical management. There are other potential issues. So for example, many clinical trials require that patients have a certain minimum expected life expectancy. And by definition, this is a really difficult criterion to coordinate, because for the most part, oncologists actually tend to overestimate life expectancy. But with that being said, so by definition, estimating life expectancy is subjective. To some extent, performance status is subjective. And so, you know, these are all considerations you have to make when you're enrolling patients. There has been a push to modernize eligibility criteria. So for example, unless it's really strongly needed for patient safety, many modern trials are not just ruling out patients who have, for example, well-controlled HIV or treated hepatitis C, because unless this really poses a serious safety barrier, this is a group of patients that would otherwise be being ruled out, honestly, unnecessarily. And so, you know, that's an example of how we want to modernize our eligibility criteria and avoid ruling out patients unnecessarily from enrolling on studies.
So in your opinion, really, what does the future look like for clinical trial enrollment, specifically for this disease? And I guess more specifically, what should be the focal point or the priority for professionals to ultimately improve enrollment?
I think there are a range of directions that pancreatic cancer trials are moving. I think one approach we're increasingly seeing is increasing use of studies in the neoadjuvant or locally advanced but a non-metastatic setting. This is a group of patients that typically a robust performance status at the time of diagnosis. So hopefully you're not seeing a lot of disease-induced poor performance status that may otherwise limit enrollment. This is still a very high need group of patients in that we know with newly diagnosed pancreatic cancer, even if it's not metastatic, if it's kind of locally advanced, unresectable, we know that survival is still limited and that there are many other novel treatment modalities that are needed in this patient population. This is also appealing in that for patients who do ultimately end up having surgery, you end up having additional measures of endpoints like the response at the time of surgery, and you have tissue available for more pharmacodynamic kind of testing and more biomarker-based testing to better understand whether your drugs were hitting their targets and other potential prognostic or even predictive biomarkers. There is an increasing push towards studies looking at maintenance therapies. So the approval of olaparib in the BRCA1 and 2 germline mutant populations through the POLO study was really exemplified how this is a new pathway towards regulatory approval. We know that patients can only tolerate platinum-based therapies for a limited duration of time before they need to pare down to a maintenance approach for tolerability, particularly from neurotoxicity. And so this is another area where novel drugs may well be increasingly studied while still hopefully improving the significant, meeting the significant need that patients are having in this disease setting.
And lastly, is there anything that I haven't asked regarding this article or your perspective that you feel is important to share?
Again, I just think it's important to highlight a few features. Number one, we need to be thinking pretty broadly about trial eligibility as a whole, both in the neoadjuvant setting and in the metastatic setting, including maintenance-based trials. Number two, I think it's important to stress that with newer drugs being developed, we need to think broadly about potential biomarkers and how to detect these biomarkers. While biologic features such as microsatellite instability or the presence of, say, a KRAS G12C mutation are uncommon in pancreatic cancer, they certainly are out there and would have a dramatic impact on patient treatment options or trial options. I think it's important to be proactively assessing patients for these aberrations, ideally through tumor-based testing, but understandably, most patients actually end up not having sufficient tissue. So I think having a low bar to screen for these aberrations through other modalities, such as circulating tumor DNA, is really important. I would also stress that guidelines do recommend that patients all be assessed for germline mutations in BRCA1 or 2 or other DNA damage repair aberrations, which would impact eligibility for PARP inhibitors or other kinds of clinical trials. I think the approval of olaparib in this group of patients is a tremendous breakthrough, but it's still only the beginning. And there, you know, we need to continue to identify these patients both for their standard of care treatment and also to identify novel treatment approaches in these group of patients. And so I think that's something I'd really like to stress.
Great. Well, Dr. Lee, thank you so much for taking some time to speak with me about these two articles. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Matt.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcast. The Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.